I'm aware of the B-52s and madness.
Don't do that. Do this. I think that is the most original thing, actually, because it's so peculiar.
Yeah.
You know, I think out of all that mob, that was one of the most original sounds. Very good drumming, very good bass, and all that.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we're joined by Woody Woodgate of Madness, who, as well as providing a sonic backdrop to popular culture in the UK and beyond in the last 40 years, Madness won the Ivor Novello for Outstanding Song Collection in 2000. Woody joined in the late 70s and has been a constant ever since, and today we'll be hearing about that journey as well as what it was like turning Buckingham Palace into a council estate, working with Ian Dury on his last recording session, being the band who were asked to fill a headline slot at a Paris festival the night Oasis officially split, the memories of playing the Olympic closing ceremony, whatever happened to the sitcom that was written about Madness by Richard Curtis and Ben Elton when they were in their absolute prime, and what they did to get banned from Top of the Pops four times, and of course we'll discuss some of the writing and recording processes of classics such as House of Fun, Baggy Trousers and It Must Be Love. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Woody Woodgate of Madness. Thanks for joining today, Woody. How's it going?
Very good, Chris. Wow, that was an amazing intro. You did that so eloquently.
Thank you very much. After about a load of cutouts, that's what it is.
No, it was really good.
Thank you very much. So you were just telling me you've been busy playing some shows this summer that sound slightly unique with these stately homes, is that right?
We started doing Stately Homes a couple of years ago. There was what was called a forest tour. And that a lot of stately homes and the people who own the forests, the Forestry Commission, in fact, there you go.
Right.
I finally got there. Have vast tracts of land across this country that we've never seen because we only kind of travel along motorways and not often venture onto A roads and B roads. But there are great swathes of this country owned by gentry for millennium.
Right.
It's just a fascinating world out there. But a lot of country stately homes are funded by live gigs these days because they've realised that there's a great audience out there as long as you get the right band.
Yeah.
And it pays for their electricity bill for a year or, you know, their new roof or, you know, maintaining that wall that keeps everyone out.
So you can't go ever into the stately home if you're a fan. It's just the backdrop behind the stage, is it? How does it work?
Well, often they set up the stage in the gardens.
Nice.
And your view is this amazing stately home.
Beautiful.
And there are quite a few around the country.
And are they Madness specific gigs, or they do you have lots of different people on the bills? Are they your gigs?
No, Madness specific gigs. Good. Yeah. And then when we've done a couple of manor houses here and there, we go off to Europe and join in with the festivals.
Nice.
And play with all the bands that are we know and love. So in Europe there's a nice mixture of. Now we could play. I mean, we did one year. We played with Placebo. We've done.
Nice.
You know, I mean, it's Europeans aren't so worried about genres, as in, you know, you could be like a heavy metal rock band and have Madness on at the same time. You know, we're
really
yeah.
Oh, okay. They jump between genres much. You don't get so much of that in the UK, do you? You've got quite a lot of festivals that are specific to a genre, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Now tell us. I mean, you play obviously so many shows. You're so experienced. The festival thing always interests me in regards to kind of the setup and the fact that I'm guessing you never really get a sound check at a festival and that kind of stuff.
No.
It's pretty much straight on. Talk us through the challenges and advice you give to young musicians playing a festival who, you know, would love to have an hour sound check and look like they might do at their own gigs, but you just straight into it. What are the challenges with that?
Well, the challenges generally are that you haven't got your perfect setup and your monitor mix and what have you. So the ideal way to play any gig, really, is to scrap all monitors and to go back to the basics. If you know that you're going to be doing a lot of live gigs, then honestly, just for a drummer, don't have monitors for your drums. Play off the kit itself. So look, when you're in a room, you can hear everything.
Yeah.
Can't you?
Yeah.
Can't you? I mean, they're really loud. So you can hear your bass drum, you can hear everything. And then what you do is you ask for a little bit of bass, you know, or whatever, you know, just to be in there, and never have it louder than your kit. So, you know, it just sits in there with what you're playing. And then you just add things, you know, a bit of guitar or keyboards or, you know, that annoying bloke at the front or woman at the front who ruins all songs by singing. You know, all the fiddly stuff on top. No, I mean, I'm being serious. No, I'm joking. No, but you just get what you want and learn to play with as little as possible. If anything, only have in the monitor what you really cannot hear on stage. And the trick is, the smaller the venue, get rid of stuff in your monitoring. And the bigger the stage, then you've got every excuse to bring stuff in.
Yeah.
But I did, for years, I learned this trick with Voice of the Beehive when I was with
Great them. Band. I've been listening to them the last few days. Loved some good tunes in there. Yeah,
I mean, it started off with just simply bringing in a bit of bass. And the fact that we played quite small venues, I could hear the girls, you know, out their own monitors. And the guitarists were so bloody loud. But, you know, it was, you know, but it was nice, you know, and... The other trick as well, and this is one we learned from Crowded House, was if we're talking about teaching people to kind of adapt to their environment.
Yeah.
If you are at a large venue, like let's say you're bunged on, you know, Glastonbury stage, and you know you think, oh my goodness, it's bloody enormous, this stage. Don't be intimidated by the size of the stage. Do exactly the same setup as you normally would in a tiny stage, as in get as close as you possibly can. Because Crowded House had this amazing trick of, they just had a small Persian rug and they put it on the floor and they set up around that. And it didn't matter what size venue. And the fact was, they looked absolutely awesome because they communicated and they connected on a really... a great level. You know, they just little glances across to each other and they looked so cool because they were just like this tight-knit unit. And years later I saw who was it, the Rolling Stones at the O2 or something, and they were doing the big stadium thing where they're all separate, miles away from each other, giving it all large, and it was pretty terrible until they all gathered on a tiny little part of the stage, got really close together, and then that part of the stage went off into the audience and along the thing. That was their kind of rock and roll trick. But what you really liked was that all of the spots, all of the lights focused in on a very tiny area, and it really looked intimate. And it's cool.
And
the band, we're all used to being in a rehearsal room where we're all really close together and it's all bloody loud and hardly anyone can hear any instrument at all because it's just a cacophony of sound and you get used to it. If you can get used to that, you can play anything. And a lot of the time when drumming, you know, it's muscle memory.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't even hear yourself, and yet just have faith that you're doing the right thing, because you've played a song over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. There's no way you're getting it wrong, because you've done it over and over and over again. It's muscle memory. So the thing to do is relax. On a big, huge stage, it's like being caught in the headlights of a car. It's like you're like a rabbit, you know, and it is terrifying if you've never done big gigs before. But you've just got to remember, just imagine you're in your rehearsal studio, and because you've taken my advice and set up really close with the rest of the band and ignored the stage manager of a big venue, you know, you can't stand there, mate. Well, yes, you can. Move my bloody amp closer to the drummer and let's all be a tight... Because you get support from each other. Because when your mate's, like, flipping 20 feet away... over there,
yeah,
you know, you feel isolated and alone, and it's not a band. You don't feel connected, so don't do that.
What about non-verbal communication on stage? Obviously, you say it's so noisy. Do Madness have like a coded thing going on, or is it just intuition, having played so much together for years?
It is intuition, because we played together for... But to be honest, we all would do our own thing anyway. It would like mad, just mad eclectic, just nuttiness. But it's enjoying yourself, and that's how Madness came. You know, I mean, it's you do need some kind of communication, though. You know, when you're going to start a song, when you're going to finish a song.
Yeah.
But no.
With you just mentioned to me sometimes on some tracks in the past you played to a click track. Do you feel that that takes the feel out of playing live a little bit? Do you feel sometimes a bit of a slave to the click? Like, do you think there's a restriction by playing to a click track?
Yeah, all the click tracks that I've ever set up, and it is, I like to set them up so I put a lot of percussion in my click track.
Mm.
There's nothing, you know, like don't like a cowbell or some generic boring thing. I put loads of percussionists in there, and so it's kind of like playing with Santana, which is really, and because it makes it exciting.
Yeah.
And the other thing that absolutely is guaranteed is that whatever you've done in the studio, you play quicker live. So,
because of adrenaline.
Yeah, so it's always a good idea to whack it up at least 4 or 5 BPM.
Right. Okay. So you, is that a choice then? To when you say play it, is it because of adrenaline, or is it,
it is
just
purely because of adrenaline? Okay. Because you even when you sped it up, you will feel like you're going through treacle.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's like it feels agonizingly slow, and you think, God, this needs to be quicker.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, because you know, because you're pumped. Just a count in itself is like way out.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good to... anyway, the exciting thing is that when you fill a song full of percussion and you fill all the holes, you can sit back. Because I'm not a particularly flary, fancy drummer, I allow space for the rest of the musicians, because there are so... You know,
there's a lot going on.
So I've got to simplify stuff.
Mm.
So to be rock solid and simple, you know, for me it's quite painful when you're playing live. As I said, you feel like you're going through treacle, because it's slow and sluggish. So if you excite it all by kind of having multiple rhythms and exciting stuff going on. You know, I mean, I put congas in and shakers and, you know, rattles and everything. And
is that your creative outlet in Madness, in a way, if it is a case that you have to kind of simplify what you're playing, do you think? Is there a frustrated drummer that wants to play a bit more within you?
There was at the beginning, but it's when it's when you're shown at a very early age how effective playing very little can be.
Mm.
It actually can be quite exciting, and then you go the other way, and there are bits. I love a record where you go, God, that roll's amazing, and you want to put the arm back on the record and go back to play it again, or you press rewind on your cassette player. See how old I am. So you just want to go, wow, and it only happens once.
Yeah.
Those exciting moments, and they're so, I don't know, so tasty, really. So but they're things I've always aspired to, rather than, you know, the Narada Michael Waldens or the Billy Cobhams of the world, who I do actually love. I mean, I do appreciate all that kind of stuff. I love that style of music, but it's not my world. It's just not appropriate for Madness.
Where do you go to channel the requisite energy for performance if you're a bit flat on that day? So let's say you're travelling between gigs and you're knackered, you've not slept, that kind of thing, but you want to get that energy. What do you do to kind of channel that? Or does that still come from the excitement of playing a gig after so long?
It's a funny one, because I think the only thing you can do is relax. You just have to relax, and as I said, we have talked about muscle memory before, and just let it be. There's a thing, whereas you feel tired and flat, and the thing to do is not force it. Never force it. Just relax and it will come, because music is a wonderful thing. And it sometimes takes a couple of songs, or it might just be instantaneous. But if you're tired and flat, the thing to do is just settle into the kit as a drummer.
Yep. That's
the only thing I can, you know, give advice on.
Yeah.
And just play, you know, and take it easy. Don't push. Don't push. Obviously, you see, there's a funny thing where you say, in your head, you're going, oh, I'm sluggish and slow. And in fact, you're never sluggish and slow, really, unless you really are kind of going for that sort of shoegazing style of music, you know, where you can be completely self-indulgent. And
but madness sloppy. Requires your energy, I think. Yeah. Madness requires your energy. So I wonder what you can do to channel that when, you know, on a day.
Well, the best thing in the world for me, honestly, is to be hydrated, clear-minded, you know. I mean, you know, over the years I found that alcohol never worked. It always just made the performance. You know, that's when you're sluggish and tired.
Mm-hmm.
And not really on it, so it's a funny old thing. It's just being I don't know, hydrated and clear minded, and you know, don't eat too close to a gig, and don't go on hungry either. So it's a bit like an athlete.
It is, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. No, it is. It really seriously is. And don't be too. I like lots of sleep as well. I mean, you know, I sleep pretty much whenever I can get sleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think, oh, no, I should be up and about, I should be doing this. But really, you know, you've got a gig to do at the end of the day. So reserve your energy.
The devil's in the detail. I love this. This is a great insight. Thank you. And what about, you know, some of those songs have such an emotional impact on audiences. You've played them for 40 years. It'd be natural to become more and more detached from some of these songs, you know, and maybe feel like you're running through the motions. Every band would have gone through that with some songs, but these songs mean so much to so many people. So where do you go to kind of channel that emotion, if you like, so you're really putting a performance that really matters to the audience on songs that you've played a million times?
It's funny. If you just play the song, you'll get a reaction from the audience.
Mm.
I know it sounds, you could be completely, what happens is you start the song, so you don't even have to think about emotions. You just have to play it correctly.
Yeah.
It's a really weird thing. There's actually, I get pleasure from playing the song correctly, you know, precisely with dynamics.
Mm.
Just being a professional, that's what I get pleasure from. And from that, just the simple fact that it's being played so well, people know the songs, they interact with the energy on the stage anyway. And symbiotic?
Okay.
It is. So we play the song, the audience reacts, we love it.
Yeah.
So you give a bit more.
Nice.
You don't do it consciously, it's subconscious, but it feels good.
Nice.
You feel good, audience feels good, and it goes round in circle, and you just get this heightened, there's a lot of love in the room type vibe, you know. I mean, and there is.
Must be a wonderful feeling.
It is. You can see why people can be very, very, you get an adrenaline buzz, so you come off stage and you feel really good, and then there is that period where you feel flat as a pancake, because you can't expect to be up on, you know, be going on a roller coaster you know all the time. And also the thing is, you've got to be very, very, very careful, because of that adulation you get from people. You know, you can't take that into life, because, you know, your day-to-day life, you've got to be very aware of the fact that, you know, people adoring and loving you. It's not necessarily that they're adoring and loving you, they're loving the music. And, you know, you've got to be very careful to not confuse the two, you know, thinking that the sun shines out of a part of your body all day long because you play this great music. You know, it's a
Is it hard not to? There have been times in the past, you know, your whole career has been in, you know, in the music industry, and you know, you joined Mantis at such a young age. Have you slipped into that kind of way of thinking in the past, do you think?
You can't tell. The only thing you can do is you hope not.
Yeah.
Because you'll only ever know you're acting like an idiot when someone tells you.
Yeah.
And they've got to be pretty close to you to say, you know what, Woods, you know, don't be like that. You know, it does you no favours at all. And it takes a good friend to tell you that. You know, it's quite a... there's some really lovely, humble people in the business, and they're the ones I aspire to.
Mm.
You know, there's some... It's an absolute honour to be up there, and it's a real I don't know, a real gift really, to be given.
Yeah. You've worked very hard for that. I mean, it's not necessarily just a gift, you know.
I have worked very hard, and we are, you know, I have to say, I can say that I'm surrounded, and I've been very lucky to be surrounded by so many amazing musicians and great songwriters in the band, you know, and it is great. But I've also met some incredibly talented musicians out there who've never made it, and it's absolutely, you wonder why. So that's why I say it's a gift, because, you know, I don't know, there is something special about Madness, and I saw it when I first saw them play. You know, before I joined the band.
What was it?
I don't know, and I still don't know what it is. There's just that, there's something about... There was only... there was Bedders and Barzo and Chris. They were the three members I saw. And there was something about the sound that they made that was just a bit quirky, a bit cranky. Mm. But it had something about it. And I really liked it. I wasn't keen on the drummer, Gary, because I thought I could do a better job, but I was a young, egotistical teenager with a massive ego. No, it wasn't that at all. It's just, I really liked the band, and I would have loved to have been in them, and I was lucky enough to get that opportunity.
We'll come on to some of the classic songs in a moment. I would like to pick you up on something you said about how you pride yourself on your professionalism. Like, that's the kind of barometer, if you like, of what you see as something that you want to aim for each time. And you'll be pleased to know that something I went to... So on Saturday, I went to the Chelsea-Arsenal game, and I was with a group of guys, and...
Are you Chelsea or Arsenal?
I'm Chelsea. Top man. There we go. It was a good result. And we went to the game, and afterwards went for a pint, and there's one of the guys who I'd not met, and he was a sound engineer, and he said, oh, I worked with Madness years ago.
Right.
He couldn't remember exactly when it was, he said, but we were doing something, it was fun, like an advert or something like that.
I hope it was nice.
Yeah, no. So I said to him, if you could, like, in one, like, what is your memory of Madness? Because it'd be great to get that insight. And the phrase he used, excuse my language, was fucking slick, fucking professional. And he said, for a band who, like, if you watch all their videos, they're so kind of, you know, a bit out there, a bit crazy, you know, it's a lot of fun going on. Like, he surprised, in a way, like, how slick and professional that you were. So much so that we finished up early and watched England v Turkey together afterwards, like, all together. And he said that's kind of... it's really...
Any other day, if England weren't playing, we'd be absolutely shoddy and slapdash.
There we go.
Wouldn't have turned up. No, that's not true. That's so, very nice of him to say that.
So the interesting thing with this is, was it stated at an early stage between the band that no matter how kind of carefree and fun you were in and conveying that publicly in your videos, that there was a real hard-working ethic behind it and professionalism, or is that just something that came naturally between all of you? Do you ever remember sitting down and going, when it comes to music, we are taking this really seriously, and it's two separate things? Or
I think you've got to understand Mike Barson to answer that question. He's dogmatic to the oomph degree. I mean, he can't turn up on time for anything, but he's very very determined individual. And the reason I mentioned Mike is that in the early days, he would insist on more rehearsals and go over and over and over songs until we got them right. He was the driving force behind the discipline of a band in the early stages. And then, of course, Mark and I, the bass player Bedders and I, for anyone who doesn't know that generic term, Mark, would work tirelessly on the rhythm section, you know, just getting the notes. You know, if I go boom or ba-boom, it makes a bloody difference. Mm. It makes a great deal of difference because, I don't know, it just makes the whole thing tighter. And you want to know where you're going. You know, Mark and I will make a decision whether or not we play a certain amount of notes, and if it's appropriate to sometimes leave the, you know, tightness behind and be a bit looser, as in, you know, I could add a few more bass drum beats than he plays, and vice versa, he could add the holes in, fill in the holes, or we're as tight as a duck's arse. It's you know, we make those kind of decisions, but we work on it.
Yeah.
And those kind of I don't know, precise little things make such a difference. And also, you know, we touched on it earlier when you asked me about the style of drumming. You know, do I want to be a flary, you know, and I say I've got to give the band space. It was really apparent in the early stages. Clive Langer made me play, at the time I thought it was the most ridiculous minimalistic drum beat on the planet. It was Nice Man George, In the Middle of the Night, mm-hmm. on the first album. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I literally go boom, cat, boom, cat, cat, boom, something like that. And whereas before I was like, you know, doing rolls and filling all the holes, and I felt so awkward. But then when I heard the final track, I went, oh my God, that is so cool.
Mm.
And that's what it's all about. And Mark would, you know, his bass line would be appropriate to the drums. It's, you know, we work on these things a lot. Barzo was the main driving force. I've gone off piste a bit, but
not at all. No, but it's giving an insight into the fact that how much you cared about the detail and getting it right. And I just think you've hit a real sweet spot for like young bands. Like, you look like you're having so much fun. It looked like a kind of a laugh, but below the surface there was just that level of kind of extra detail and drive that obviously was coming from within, that's just so critical. And I think it's really worth capturing that. I think that's really, really important to focus on. Moving on to the Buckingham Palace thing. Mm. So I've been telling a few people about this story, and every time I tell them, their jaws hit the ground, which is you're playing, I think it was at Queen's Jubilee?
Yeah.
And this was a ballsy decision, I think, and it's fantastic, where what the band did, they played on top of Buckingham Palace, but with a fantastic, must have been the best projector ever, they projected a council estate onto Buckingham Palace, whilst the Queen, Prince William, Prince Harry, Prince Charles were all watching. Quite a ballsy statement, I thought it was fantastic.
It's time to welcome one of Britain's best loved bands. They've sold millions of records, packed venues throughout the world, and now they're playing on the roof of Buckingham Palace. Go crazy for Madness!
And tell us about that. Was there any resistance to that? Did they know it was going to happen? Whose decision was that to go down that route? Because it was fantastic. It was a real statement to a huge audience at the time.
Well, I think the idea for the projection came from the Our House video itself.
Yep.
Where we did it in a working man's kind of street, and we kind of did the northern cloth caps and, you know, ecky thump, you know, like it's gritty down the mines type approach to it. And what we wanted to do in the song was to go from a council estate to a working man's, you know, little cobbled street house where you walk into the front room off the street, kind of, you know, we wanted to cover all angles, you know. And we went to Hugh Hefner's house and, you know, hung out in his swimming pool and played on his squash court, and we showed that as well. You know, his big dining room table, you know, how the other half live.
Yeah.
So it was our house.
Right.
It might not be in the middle of a street, it might be in the middle of, you know, a park, but we wanted to cover all angles. So I think what the people who put together those projections did was take one element of the video that we did, you know, being the council estate, and it was just one part of the whole, you know, video that they were inspired by. But it was fine, because I think it does the Queen no harm at all to be in touch with her, you know, the common man.
But it seemed like a statement from you guys. So when you watch it, it seems like it was like, okay, one talk of Buckingham Palace, right, let's turn it to the council, which is great.
That's what we are. I mean, you know, hopefully, not that it was done intentionally, but I think people do relate to us, because hopefully we're unpretentious and we represent normal people. I mean,
that's why it's great.
The statement working class is a bit of a misnomer, because we come from all kinds of backgrounds, you know, not necessarily working class. We, you know, we have a middle class culture as well, bohemian, you name it. It's pretty arty as well, you know. But it touches the heart of the common man, you know. And I don't mean, you know, commoners. I mean the general public can relate, hopefully, to madness and the fact that we're, I don't know, we don't go around with foppy sleeves and makeup and high heel shoes.
It was a brilliant statement, and I'd love to have seen the camera on Duke of Edinburgh's face when it happened. It was fantastic.
Well, I'm sure he's been to a couple of council estates himself, you know. But they are.
Well, he
know,
came to. I'm from Romford and originally, and he came to for the first time. They came like after years and years and years, and they met this boy who'd written a letter saying you've never actually been to Romford. And when he was introduced to him, he shook his hand. This kid's like 12 years old. Duke of Edinburgh said to him, "I'm surprised you can read."
He
was on the front of the paper the next day. Yeah,
it's just, it's unbelievable.
Like, yeah, so
it's a shame, because the royal family back in the war, after, you know, they were, the people loved them, because they went out and went to bomb sites and all kinds of, you know, the East End. They were down there all the time.
Yeah, pulling pints and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Great publicity, PR. Yeah, their PR officer did a great job.
Well, when you got, which brings me on to the
very cynical, aren't I?
you got banned four times from Top of the Pops, and I believe Michael Hurl, who's a producer, said to Suggs, "You're an embarrassment to yourself, you're an embarrassment to the BBC, and you're an embarrassment to the Queen." Mm. And then years later, obviously, you're playing Buckingham Palace, you know, in front of the Queen, that kind of thing. You know, why were you banned from Top of the Pops four times? What was it that you were doing? What was it that they didn't particularly like?
I think we didn't particularly like, and we thought it was a complete nonsense, where you turned up at literally 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning to do a run through, and then another run through, and then wait until lunchtime for another run through, and then a dress rehearsal later on in the day, and then the actual program.
Blimey.
It's an absolute nonsense. And
did you have to mime back then? Was that mime?
Yeah, it was all mime. So. Yeah, and they could have set all the camera shots up beforehand. And the other thing was, so a lot of the band wouldn't turn up, and it was really ridiculous. They kept you at the BBC all day, and there was a bar on the fourth floor.
Mm, there we go.
So, you know, there was a lot of drinking and a lot of mucking about, and they didn't like it. You know, we were young, and it was just one of those things. Also, when they done and rehearsed all of their camera shots, you know, we're not the sort of band that go to queue. So Lee would leap off the stage, a lot of the band would go walk about, you know, in the audience, and it was all like, this is, so the camera would be there and there wouldn't be a band member. So it would really absolutely rile the director. Go, "Where's the band?" You know, like, because it makes them look stupid.
Yeah.
You know, but then the more that we discovered that it made them look stupid, of course, the more we did it. And we would you know, there were all kinds of antics in lifts and things, with fire extinguishers and, I don't know, the general nonsense of young teenagers. But really, they brought it upon themselves because of the whole union thing of keeping all the staff in work. So they kind of gave them all jobs, you know, ridiculous jobs all day long, for the license payer to spend loads of money on people that really could have just turned up in the afternoon, stuck a camera on us, done one run through, got an idea of the shots and the lighting, and then off you go.
Four times though, that's impressive. There's got to be some kind of record.
Yeah,
kudos for that. So let's talk about some of the individual songs. So It Must Be Love was a Labby Siffre song. Why did you choose that cover?
I've no idea. I think it was Mike Barson. Mike came in and said, "I've got this song. I really think it's a great song to do." We liked doing the occasional cover here and there, like we covered One Step Beyond.
It's Prince Buster, was
Prince
that?
Prince Buster, yeah. Madness by Prince Buster. I can't remember if we'd done any Kinks song, but anyway, it was just a song that Mike liked, and the good thing was Mike just played it, you know, and he said, you know, he seemed to think everyone knew it, and a lot of the band members did. I'd never heard it in my life.
Yeah.
And
so it wasn't a popular, well-known song much? Or
it might have been, but it doesn't mean to say I would have.
No, yeah.
I'm not really, you know, I wasn't really the popular song kind of guy. I was more into prog rock and weird jazz fusion stuff. But anyway, that's another story. So he came in with this. I'd never heard it before in my life, and I'm really glad I didn't, because I played it with a completely open mind. Hence it. I was really surprised when I did hear the original, but it skipped. It's 12/8 rather than 4/4.
Oh.
So
Right, okay.
I never thought I'd miss you half as much as I do.
We played it kind of on the floor four, you know, very kind of, you know, it's a much more rigid version. And all the stops and starts and things were an invention of Clive Langer. He loved all those, Clive Langer being the producer of Mad and stuff. So it became really unique, and it became one of ours, really. But Mike brought it in, and I'm glad I didn't hear the original.
As soon as I wake up, every night, every day, I know that it's you I need to take the blues away. It must be love, love, love. It must be love, love.
Another classic of yours. So when I went to uni years ago, we had this bastard tutor who was doing it for good reasons, where he would say, right, we've set up a band and we have a gig in a pub on a Saturday night, and 2 days before he'd tell us what the songs were we'd have to do. And I was on the course as a singer-songwriter, but obviously doing covers, you couldn't do your own stuff, so I was kind of thrusted to be a singer. And I was told in 48 hours we were going to be performing Baggy Trousers, which means I had to learn all those bloody lyrics all the way through.
Wow.
Which I still have got kind of, you know, engraved into my eyelids, I think, because I just to learn it kind of was pretty intense. Such a great tune, a song that's close to my heart, actually. What's your memories of the writing process or recording in that particular song?
Difficult, really, because it was right in the middle of a mad process of writing songs very, very quickly. It was on the second album, absolutely.
I think.
And we wrote that in about 2 weeks in a studio in Olympia called Gnomis. And we literally had a board up where people came in with a song. We wrote the song on the board. And
what do you mean? How do you mean wrote it on the board?
Well, like a blackboard, you know, like, but it wasn't a blackboard. It was a, you know,
what, chord charts or like?
No, just literally, I mean, someone, but they're, what we have is a great huge piece of paper, almost, you know, and we'll write all the songs that people bring in.
Oh, sorry, right, I got you.
So they'll bring in a song, right, okay, so we'll have Baggy Trousers, Embarrassment, you know, I don't know, That Close, I don't know, but maybe I've done the wrong album.
He's absolutely, I'll just check out.
Yeah, okay, so then people would write names of songs down, and then you go, okay, what's the first on the list? Okay, that one, then you turn the piece of paper over to the next big, huge piece of paper, and then someone would say, what are the chords?
Mm.
So you write the chords down, and then it's like, well, how does it go? And then it's bosh, done.
So, and with so that one, was that Suggs singing that kind of rhythm? That
I can safely say that Suggs has been quoted as saying that he loved the way Ian Dury wrote, and, you know, in his colloquial tongue, as in, he wanted a song where it wasn't all flowery and poetic, it was how you spoke.
Mm.
So he was very pleased. He said it was the first song, apparently, he has been quoted as saying this before, but he was pleased with his lyric writing, but he got it kind of bang on. And the misnomer about Baggy Trousers is that the Baggy Trousers do not relate to the kids.
Oh.
It's actually the teachers.
Oh, right.
Because he said it was the teachers that wore baggy trousers.
Ah, right, I gotcha.
So it's interesting, but I mean, kids wear baggy trousers as well, so it could be anyone. But his image was baggy trousers, you know, the capes and the boards on the head, whatever they call them.
House of Fun, so my uncle told me when I was quite young, about probably 13 or 14, that the entire song was about buying condoms and being too embarrassed to say
yes
at the chemist, tell you what, and I listened to this, and that is true, is that right?
You go in and you go, I'll have some aspirin, and I'll have, those...
balloons with a feather-like touch, I think.
Party poppers that go pop in the night. Yeah. Yeah. It's like anything, you say anything but condoms, yeah.
And so how did, I mean, that's such a genius... And
it's Lee Thompson, his writing is just inspired. Lee is an amazing lyricist, and the thing is, he's not grammatically correct, which actually helps his writing. So he can speak the way he speaks, which isn't necessarily grammatically correct, but it means so much more. It comes from the heart, and you understand what he's bloody going on about. So he can get away with. You know what I'm saying, you know, not proper English.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ian Dury a moment ago. I believe it's a case that you recorded on his last ever, what was his last ever recording. Tell us about that. Was that, how long before he passed away was that?
It was only a couple of months, I think.
Really?
Yeah, he was really very frail, fragile when he came and did the video with us. I mean, it was not very well at all, but it was you know, very lovely of him to come along. I mean, he did love us all, it seemed. I mean, he was always lovely to us and used to hold court. He was brilliant because we just loved him. Lee Thompson, again, had this image of this bloke called Freddie and, you know, his antics and, you know, criminal whatever getting... You know, whatever he got up to, and there's a great kind of a long storyline and various characters, and he wanted various voices, and he could hear Ian Dury's, you know, awkward, blimey, like voice going on, and just wanted Ian to come and, you know, do a guest vocal on it, and so Ian did, and then appeared in the video later on. So we want Freddie for our leader.
What were his unique qualities to work, you know, what would someone, a young musician, have learned from working with Ian Dury that they might not have learned working with anyone else?
Wow. You'd have to be a bloody shit-hot musician for a start. I mean, all of the musicians in the Blockheads were extraordinary. Well, still are.
Mm.
Absolutely extraordinary. You know, the sad passing of both Ian and Charlie Charles, wasn't it? The drummer, absolutely phenomenal drummer. He died young as well, of cancer, but such a shame. What a brilliant drummer. But what any young musician would learn, how shit-hot the musicianship is, you'd have to be really bloody good. Ian was, he was quite a hard taskmaster. You'd certainly learn about someone's belligerence and stubbornness and single-mindedness from him as an individual, which you do get with great artists. You know, they know exactly what they want and they don't take any shit.
Were you on the receiving end of any of that at any point, or was he with you guys?
Never, because he was always absolutely lovely with us. Absolutely lovely.
Why do you think that was?
Because he liked us. Because he could relate to, you know, because I don't know what it would have been like working with him, but he certainly. And there's absolutely nothing wrong in it either, you know, in the sense that if you can take it, if you can take criticism and you can take, you know, great artists borderline, you know, being complete bastards and, you know, genius, you know. I mean, our wonderful Mike Barson, you know, he's very brusque at times. He knows exactly what he wants and there's absolutely no bloody getting around it, you know, and he's belligerent and, you know, very single-minded, dogmatic. I've used that word before with him.
Mm.
But he gets what he gets. Fantastic results. It's a little hard to swallow sometimes because it's like it's. But then Mike's. It's his way or the highway, and it's the same for with Ian Dury, which is, you know, there are many artists that are just absolute genius, who are given great credit for being who just produce the most extraordinary music, and they're not the most approachable people. I mean, Van Morrison is a classic case. But I mean, you know, he's got a reputation. But then, who can argue with the music? It's absolutely phenomenal, and it doesn't really matter, does it? You know, I'm sure behind closed doors he's a lovely, lovely, lovely man. In fact, I know he is because Mez, our drummer, the guy that does percussion with Madness and who stood in for me when I broke my back, will testify, you know.
And he was drummer for Van Morrison, was he?
He still is, yeah.
Oh, he still is right now, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's no, you know what I'm saying, your perception of artists, you know, but these are all things that young musicians can learn, in the sense of there's a time to step up to the plate and say, no, I'm, you know, I know what I'm good at and this is what I do, and you can be that kind of person or you could be flexible. But the one thing you do learn is, you know, who is dogmatic and belligerent and forth-minded, you know, very controlling, and who's a lot easier and lets you be, you know, do your own thing. And that is all a part of learning about the music industry.
And that dynamic's key in a band, I guess, because like I said, you've got too much of the same thing.
Well, exactly. This is why a lot of bands don't work.
Yeah,
because there's no movement there. There's no compromise.
A quote from Suggs is that a quote from Suggs is the odd blow has been thrown, but not many considering. Obviously, interband politics are tricky, and I'd like to talk you through the day in Paris where you were privy, I think, to the time when Noel and Liam decided to smash each other's guitars up, and you'd already played and you had to fill in that final slot, I believe, for the day. Talk us through that whole day. That must have been a surreal day.
Well, we turned up to a festival and there were two stages, the A stage and the B stage, and we were on the other stage, B stage. It's only because they were on A stage, you know, the A stage, and we were like, why aren't we on that? No. So we came on to a really great reception from the French audience, and did, you know, a normal Madness gig, and happy as Larry. We came off, and Oasis, who normally would be out there kind of friendly and come into the dressing room, say hello, and, you know, we, you know, because we'd done loads of gigs with them before, were very, they put a little cordon around their Paul's cabin that they were staying in, and it was kind of locked down, and then all that you heard was screaming and shouting and banging, and then I think Liam came out first. He stormed off to the back of the stage, picked up a guitar, and went back to the dressing room. Apparently, it was Noel's, one of Noel's favourite guitars, and he smashed it up. I don't know if Noel reciprocated and went off and smashed something of Liam's up. I don't know. But that's all I saw. And then it was like, oh, you know, they're brothers again, but they'll be on soon. And then there was this big commotion of, like, the promoter running into our dressing room and saying, you know, you have to go on, you know, Oasis have split up. We were like, nah, leave it out. And it was a case of Noel had got into a car and driven off. So he wasn't coming back. And it was very, you know, it just emptied their part of the backstage. And it was like, blimey. So we kind of got, the crew were asked, the crew were packing down all the gear, and they had to get all the gear back up again over to another stage. So it was quite a logistical nightmare. And then, of course, some poor sod had to announce the fact that Oasis had split up and were not playing that gig.
Oh,
and that went down like a shit sandwich, excuse my language. Yeah. No, that didn't go down very well. You can edit that.
Because, no, well, they're the headline. I mean, there'd been a lot of people there who would have bought tickets to see him, I guess. So, yeah, having to...
But the nice thing was, that, you know, we were backstage and we heard this absolute kind of... Oh, boo, crowd going absolutely
really
mental. And then, the guy in French was... you know, blah 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 blah, blah, blah. Madness, and then the crowd actually went hooray.
Oh, nice.
So we went, oh blimey, we got some. But it was like, oh my god, what kind of reception are we going to get? Because it's like, you know, we were like the, I don't know, the second hand band, really, weren't we? You know, everyone was there for Oasis, and it's like, yeah, but it's us, hello again. We've already done a gig, but we'll play all the songs again. And I remember our trombone player. We did Iron Shirt, a version we do of Iron Shirt. You know, Prodigy have done it. We've done it, our trombone player did Wonderwall, the whole of Wonderwall, as the solo. It's really brilliant because it's probably in completely the wrong key.
Yeah.
Not the same notes, but for some strange reason it actually worked. But that's my memory of that gig. But it was kind of weird. The whole place just went, I can't believe Oasis have split up. And we saw it all happening.
And I guess there was nothing, you didn't try and get in there and mediate or anything like that, band office.
Oh, no, you couldn't get anywhere near them.
Really?
Yeah, right. No, they'd done a security...
Oh, security, all right.
...lockdown... before it even kicked off. So whereas normally it would be open dressing rooms and everyone going and saying hello and you know, visiting everyone, which is the normal thing you do. It was kind of weird. It was they obviously something was going on and they didn't want to talk to anyone that day.
Well done for saving the day and getting the crowd on board. And you did your comeback gig, because I know you split for a few years, and you did your comeback gig, I think, at Finsbury Park, and you played to 75,000 people over 2 days. And I love that there's loads of different sources that say that, like, there was so much dancing that was going on that, like, there was numerous reports in local flats that they were shaking. That must have been such an experience for you, given that you've gone away for that long, and to see fans loving it as much as that. Did you have anxieties about coming back and not playing to so many people?
Oh, completely. But it was all, we did a little gig. We had our greatest hits coming out.
Right.
That did really, really, really well. In fact, it got to number one. And it, no, it just outsold everything. And it knocked Simply Red off the number one block, which was great. And so it was the right time. And then obviously a live gig. But we were really unsure. I mean, we were happy to promote the album. You know, we did a little television advert for it, made some cameo appearances, and then that was going to be it. It wasn't going to be anything much. And then somebody said that there was a little program that someone was making, and would we play live as a band, just do a couple of songs? I think we did Madness, Baggy Trousers, and Have Some Fun, but you know, literally that.
Yeah.
And as soon as we got back on stage to do this little gig, and it was tiny, it was in the West End somewhere, I can't even remember where it was, really tiny, invited audience, oh my God, the electricity and the connection that we had as a band, it was like we'd never been away
from each
other, and it was really special, and it was like, blimey, this is, I've really missed this, this is great. Although I have to say, that is unfair. You'd think that I'd been kind of in the wilderness all this time, but I hadn't. I'd been in another amazing band, which I
Voice of the Beehive.
Voice of the Beehive. I cannot say enough how much I loved the years I was in that band. We did brilliant gigs, and I just cannot big them up enough. It was just a wonderful part of my life.
Who was writing it? Because the song, the standard songwriter is like really, really, like it's a really, really good tune to that. That song, Monsters and Angels?
Yeah.
What a chorus that is. Brilliant.
Yeah, no, it is.
So was that something, tell us about the setup with that. Was that you writing, or was it the girls?
No, it was purely the girls. And I came in with Bedders, ironically,
right
in the very early stages to help them out. Because Madness had split up in 86. Mark and I weren't doing much. In fact, I was looking for a new career. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then Dave Balf, who owned Food Records, picked up as artists.
Yeah.
The two girls.
Yeah.
And they were called Voice of the Beehive. They had a guitarist called Mike Jones, and they had no rhythm section, no bass player and drummer. So Dave just went, you know, you're not doing anything, do you fancy coming in? And we did a little EP, Bedders and I, I Walked the Earth, some other shit. Anyway, it went down really well, it was fantastic. And then started doing some gigs, and the record industry were like going mental, wanting to sign the girls. Bedders had some other projects. I think he was off with a Blockhead somewhere in Japan. So he went off and did that. And then we started looking for a bass player. Found Martin Brett, a phenomenal bass player, really good, solid as a rock, and kind of had the same work ethic as Bedders, in the sense that he would stay behind with me and we'd work all the notes, you know, and be as solid as a rock. And to be honest, Mike Jones, the guitarist, has such a huge sound.
Yeah.
You know, there's only like bass, drums and guitar. I mean, Tracy, the lead singer, she played guitar occasionally, but it didn't really add to the overall great sound. It was like one of those proper 70s. It was a bit like kind of, you know, like Bad Company, where it sounded absolutely enormous. There were only three of them.
In
the sense of the guitar, bass and drums. It was a bit like that with Voice of the Beehive, and it was really exciting because I was able to go back to my roots, as in all the bands I used to love, like who had guitars, you know, proper guitar bands. And I just had a blast and toured the world. You know, went to America more times than I'd ever been with Madness, and had a whale of a time. And then, of course, after 7 years of Voice of the Beehive, Madness came back again. And it was just at the right time because Voice of the Beehive was waning. You know, that great heightened buzz of Voice of the Beehive was just, you know, we'd hit the roof, hit the peak, and we're going down the other side. And it just seemed perfect timing Go Back to Madness, who were on the rise again.
Did you think about other careers in that time?
Absolutely.
A lot of musicians now, they have to have kind of, they call it portfolio careers, but be able to do different things because it's difficult earning a living in the music industry now. Did you dip into anything else at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was being, well, you know, not many people know I'm actually a songwriter, although I've done, you know, I'm not the most prolific writer when it comes to Madness, but, you know, over the past couple of years, I've had more and more songs on Madness albums. But at the time, I was writing with a couple of musicians, and we put a band together. It was just a bit like Curiosity Killed the Cat. I know it sounds a bit kind of naff, but, you know, that kind of funk kind of genre. Anyway, it was a little project I was thinking of getting into because I had some great musicians around me.
Mm.
However, Voice of Beehive came along, and it just seemed that was, you know, the way forward. So it was a dodgy period in my life because I didn't know where I was going. But Voice of the Beehive came along, and it saved my bacon, as it were. Don't call me. You asked me a question earlier about Finsbury Park.
Yeah.
And the shaking of the thing.
Yeah.
There was actually recorded, there's a seismologist or seismology department in Scotland with all the meters and the buildings and, you know, the things that go up and down with all the ink and stuff. And it was they detected an earthquake of 4.5 on the Richter scale.
Really?
Which is quite big.
Yes.
And they routed it down to where we were. So they kind of worked out that it must have come from... Because
It's that type of dance, isn't it? It's the Madness dance.
Well, apparently it's the same reason why the army breaks step over a bridge.
Right.
Because if you all jump up and down together, you cause a ripple, a wave effect through the earth. If you all jump up and down together, that's exactly what... 30,000-odd people did all together, you know, to the music.
Incredible.
And it just sent a shockwave out to the surrounding area.
Wow.
I mean, the place in Scotland, they knew it was 4.5 at the source. It wasn't 4.5 in Scotland because they detect absolute minimal vibrations.
Another kind of seismic show that you did was the closing ceremony at the Olympics. You did, I think, House of Fun, and you were on... I watched it yesterday. It looked like it could be a logistical nightmare in that you were on a truck that was moving the whole time.
Oh, God, it was very difficult to stay on it,
I was going to say, what were the challenges with that? Because that must have been quite disconcerting.
Well, staying on it. The thing was, when the brakes went on, everyone would... they'd fly all over the place. Yeah, so it was...
Did you have to tape down your kit or, like, nail down your kit in some way? Because that looked like it could just...
Well, it was challenging, let's put it that way. Yeah, no, it was a good laugh, though.
What do you remember about... Because that was... Yeah, obviously, so Danny Ball did the opening ceremony. I actually worked at the opening ceremony, which was amazing. And the closing ceremony was just as kind of a bigger show, and it was obviously been an amazing month in London. What do you remember of the early rehearsals? You must have been involved in that for like a year beforehand. Would that be right? Was it a long, long process to coordinate? Because it was one continuous show that went on for 2.5 hours.
No, I think we just turned up to a dress rehearsal in the day.
No, really?
Or was it the day before? I can't remember.
Wow.
Yeah, we got on the truck and oh no, I know. It wasn't actually at the Olympic Stadium.
Mm.
It was the day before we went somewhere and drove around a big car park. And there were like hundreds of people with light bulbs on their head.
Was it in Dagenham? I think they did a load of the stuff in Dagenham.
Probably
They did all rehearsals in Dagenham, yeah.
So we kind of, we did that, and then the next day we did a run through very quickly around the actual stadium itself. It was empty.
Yeah.
And then obviously the show. And it was nice because we hung out with, what's that flipping band? Young kids who are like absolutely massive. What's the biggest boy band in the world?
Not One Direction.
Thank you. There you go. That's the one. See, One Direction, my brain's going. Forgetting their name.
So that was the highlight of...
Well, One Direction, it was really... Because they were on the trailer next to us.
Oh, okay.
So we were hanging out with them all day long. You know, like young kids.
Who must have been so wide-eyed and...
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but they were... It was really nice. Because you know what? They're actually really... But then... They were really nice. God knows what they're like now.
Yeah.
Being affected by the industry. But they were really nice. And then the other memory I have of that, and it was really telling, was, first of all, Chelsea were playing Manchester City in a charity Shield game, I think it was.
Mm.
Or some game, anyway. And Liam was there. And everyone kind of goes, oh, cool, Liam, what a, you know. He could not have been bloody nicer. What a lovely chap. You know, he's very charismatic, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's not this kind of bullish, you know, ape arm swinging, you know, individual that people think he is. And it was really nice, and he's so educated about his football, and really not like going, oh, Chelsea, they're rubbish, oh, get out of here. He was like, you know, he knew all the names of the players.
Mm.
He could tell the way the system was going.
Mm.
And although I think they beat us, he was really magnanimous and very humble about the game. It was like, that was an experience and a half.
Mm.
I met David Beckham. I thought, he was, what a nice chap.
Was he?
Really lovely.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, really engaging. So all these kind of people that you think, you know, people get images of, you know, when you get them on their own, I've met some up and, you know, some big idiots in this industry, and they certainly aren't. And you know, they got a bad name, and yet really very, very nice people. And that was very telling. And the other thing I remember, which really stuck with me, was Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend. I was chatting to them, and Roger turned round to me and he said, "How old are you lot now?" I said, "Oh, you know, we're in our 50s. And he went, "Oh my God, you're so young. When you're so young, you lucky bastards." And he was like, he was going, and he turned around to Pete and he went, "Isn't that fantastic, Pete? God, just think, I wish I was in my 50s. He went, "Believe me, you've got the next decade or even two, just enjoy them." Wow. He said, "Just enjoy them because you're young." He said, "Don't ever think you're old." He said, "When you're my age, you'll look back and you'll go, I wish I was bloody that age."
Mm.
And that was such a lovely thing of him to say. And he's right.
Yeah.
Because we're still doing gigs now with loads of energy and full of life. And yet, in the back of your head, you're going, "Oh, I'm a bit old for this." And you're not.
Mm.
You know, those words from Roger Daltrey ring around my head. And they were so nice of him to say. You know,
and he's really, still an amazing performer live.
Well, of course,
his voice, he's looked after his voice.
So all this rubbish about, you know, if you're in your mid-20s or you're coming into your 30s and you think you're washed up and you're done, rubbish, absolute rubbish. You know, you got flipping the rest of your life to make it.
Great advice there from Roger Daltrey. Right, okay, so let's begin to wrap up. There's one thing I really wanted to ask you about that I found out in my research, that you piloted a show written by Ben Elton and Richard Curtis in their absolute prime. Like,
yeah.
And how many episodes were filmed?
One.
It was just a pilot?
Yeah.
What was the plot?
The plot was that we were the government... And we, you know, and all the decisions for, you know, the running of a country were made by us. And it's great.
Sounds brilliant already.
It does sound great, yeah. And but we had to report to the Queen every week to tell her what we were up to. And then behind it all was a villain, let's say.
Played by Alexei Sale.
No, by all of us.
Oh, okay.
By all of us. So we had alter egos as well.
Oh, wow.
And they were in charge of bringing down the government and bringing down madness, you know, to foil our plots, you know. Well, their plots were to foil our plans for government. And we'd have a meeting every day to kind of say, what we'd be up to, and they were just really ridiculously silly jokes all the way through. And that was just, it was just brilliant. Because the reason we got there, because Ben Elton and Richard Curtis had invited, they were involved in the Young Ones.
Yeah.
And they got us along. Obviously, we'd been on the Young Ones twice. I don't know why we got on there a second time, but obviously they liked us.
Yeah.
And Richard Curtis and Ben Elton said, you know, let's write, because they could see that it could, I don't know, you know, the Monkees. If you mix Monkees up with the Young Ones, it would be quite. Well, I mean, the Monkees was kind of like the Young Ones,
yeah,
in a sense, you know, if not a little kind of clean and squeaky.
Mm.
It was, you know, madness. We had, I mean, someone who went on to work with the Spice Girls, head of their record company, saw it as essential that each girl had an individual image, because he'd worked with us and just saw how it worked so well.
Really?
Yeah, apparently.
So you're responsible for all the Scary Spice, Ginger, well, Spice, Baby Spice.
I mean, unless he's kind of bigging himself up by having the idea. You know, he was like, you know, I've really got to, you know, I really did insist that they have, you know.
That's cool.
You think maybe that's just record company bravado, you know. Yes.
That's cool.
I signed the Beatles source.
Yeah. What are your proudest moments? Looking back, if you reflect back at your amazing career, a career that so many musicians would love to have had, what are your proudest moments?
As I keep saying, you know, we're blessed. We're a very lucky band. So you kind of think a lot of it's out of your hands. You know, you just do what you do, and you hope that other people like it. It's a kind of mixture of pride and surprise,
mm-hmm.
where you kind of go, wow, is this really happening to me? I mean, being invited by the Queen to go onto the roof of Buckingham Palace is a bit weird, because we were always considered the anarchic, anti-establishment type band, although we did connect and resonate with the general populace, which is, again, something I find it's difficult sometimes to kind of get your head around the fact that we are so loved by the British public, and that is very warming, it's lovely, and I can feel proud of that.
Mm.
That is, I suppose, the greatest gift that people have given me. You know, it's very difficult to answer that question.
What ambitions do you have left?
I have ambitions of writing and creating much more music, whether it be with Madness or with my own stuff with my brother, with other artists.
What would you want to achieve from those other projects that you haven't achieved yet?
Just recognition is one thing. The recognition of people enables you to continue to do what you're doing. Because if you are unrecognised, and, you know, it's a very costly project, self-indulgent, you know, and it's always the dream of any artist to connect with other people, is to hope that they resonate with what you're doing. Mm. And the ability to be able to be creative and have other people go, wow, that's great, is what it's all about, I think.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the worst thing in the world is if you put out a load of stuff and everyone goes, God, that's crap. That's really, you know, you kind of go, that's a bit disheartening. You know, but someone somewhere out there, you know, I'm always surprised at, I mean, I've had some lovely people come up to me and go, I bought your album. I said, which Madness album's that? They no, your album. Mm. What, my album? No. Really? They go, I love this. Like you've just said, I like Friday night, Sunday morning. Friday night, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And that's lovely. I mean, that's, you know, to be able to get somebody to, you know, get a buzz off what you do is lovely. I think the most, the one thing though is to be able to be creative yourself and to work with other, I get the biggest buzz when I work with other creative people and, you know, you work off them and then you create something new. It's just so exciting.
Final question. This is a question we ask all guests. What fears do you have for the music industry and how might those fears be addressed?
Well, my fears have already been realised. Because, which were? Well, the whole generic, you know, I said a little, I said something earlier about the way the contracts are written. You know, Lou Reed was able to get away with a load of noise on a double album so he could get out of a contract. That will never ever happen again. You know, I guarantee there'll be clauses of you cannot put silence out. It's got to be music. It's got to be of a certain, you know, they close all the loopholes. Singers now have to be of a certain type to fill a certain genre in a market. You're all boxed. You cannot, you know, they say X Factor. It's not an X Factor is something outside the box, so something new and quirky and not the norm. But what they're doing is they're putting people into the box, into boxes.
Conveyor belt.
And it's horrendous how people's careers are so short. But then they were never... The fear of the industry is from the root, from the fact that live music, you have to pay for live music. It costs a hell of a lot of money. You know, there's no surprise that... Trustafarians put together a lot of bands, you know. And I don't blame the kids for coming from money, but they are the very few who've got the ability to, you know, I mean, how in the world do you survive? You've got to get a job. If you don't have a job, you know, how do you pay for rehearsal rooms? How do you, you know, how do you get together with your mates? Because they all need... It's a very, very, very tricky situation to get a band together these days.
What needs to change?
I don't know. I think cream will always rise to the top. What will happen is there'll always be revolutions because mankind doesn't like being trapped and we like the different thing. You know, there'll be people who come along who are really, who don't fit the profile, you know. They won't be too, you know, I can't wait. They won't be particularly good looking and chiseled chinned, you know, with a perfect nose or whatever. They'll be unique and they'll do something to people's spirit. They'll touch their heart and that's when everything will change. It will be, you know, the industry will try desperately to put them into their box, you know, straighten their nose and, you know, give them a chiseled chin. And they'll be under a hell of a lot of pressure. This is the sadness of the industry. But these people will come through. You know, I believe that there'll be a revolution. You see, the thing is that people like vinyl. Everyone liked vinyl. Now there's a big demand for vinyl because the industry could not fight the fact that people actually preferred it. You know, so it's gone back to vinyl. You know, no one would ever imagine that to be the case. You know, and now it's financially viable because it works. You know, because that's what people want. People do not want cheesy flipping boxes. They don't want clean and cut. You know. The greatest records that we ever listened to are actually rough and ready with mistakes on and not particularly brilliantly recorded.
That gives it the character.
It gives it the character, and that's what we are. We're human beings. You know, We like old buildings because they're a bit cranky and a bit crooked.
Mm.
You know, we, you know, that's what we're like. Human beings are like that, and that's the way forward. So, just the only advice I can give anyone is to believe in what they're doing, if you know, and just keep doing it, because even if you don't make it in the industry, you're going to be spiritually rewarded because you're being true to yourself. And there's nothing worse than not being true to yourself. It actually is quite painful.
Mm.
And you can't, unless you're really mind-numbingly materialistic and you don't give a shit, then you won't be able to live with yourself. It's just not going to happen.
Great answer, and thank you so much today, Woody, for sharing your wisdom and experience. You've played on songs that we play for decades, long after you and I are on this planet. You've brought joy to so many people through your creativity and resilience over years, and I just want to say kudos to you for that. Thanks for your musical legacy. Keep up the great work, and keep up what you're doing. We hope you enjoyed appearing on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you very much, Chris.